Everyone has a fave Wendy's Frosty flavor. And when you're choosing from chocolate or vanilla, it's not that hard. But now there's all new Frosty Swirls and Frosty Fusions. So try picking your fave from Oreo Brownie Fusion, Pop-Tarts Strawberry Fusion, Strawberry Swirl, Brownie Batter Swirl, Caramel Swirl, and Caramel Crunch Fusion. Not so easy now, huh? For a fresh way to Frosty, gotta be Wendy's. Open till midnight or later.
At participating U.S. Wendy's, hours may vary by location. Oreo is a trademark of Mondelez International Group. Pop-Tarts is a trademark of Kellogg North America Co. LLC. Used with permission.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Focus Group podcast. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and this week we're taking you to Utah, where there's an interesting primary for U.S. Senate and where Republican voters are built just a little bit different. And that's actually what we're going to talk about today, because the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the beating heart of Utah and of its Republican electorate. The best-known Mormon from Utah in contemporary politics is obviously Mitt Romney, the 2012 GOP presidential nominee turned anti-Trump renegade who's on his way out of office. The current governor of Utah is also notably different from the national GOP. He's a much kinder, gentler soul. But these kinds of Republicans are facing headwinds even in Utah. We're going to talk about those headwinds and the role of the Mormon Church in politics more broadly. My guest today is McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic, and author of the excellent book, Romney, A Reckoning. Right here, we got it. Look, I hold up books now on my show. McKay, thanks for being here.
I love it. I'm so glad that you have that in your hands. That no better product placement than having Sarah hold that up on this show.
I love it. This was an amazing work, my friend.
Oh, thank you.
This was awesome.
Thank you.
For a political nerd like me, nothing better. And I appreciate you being here. Just a quick note up front, I'm going to use the term Mormon in this show, you know, like you do in your reporting to save syllables. So let's get into it. In 2016, Ted Cruz won the Utah caucuses with almost 70% of the vote. And Evan McMullen, my old friend Evan, got over 20% in the general election. In 2024, Donald Trump beat Nikki Haley in Utah, 56-43. It seems like Utah and the Mormons there were more resistant than most to MAGA capture, but that's eroding. And that sort of was clear, I think, in some of our focus groups. Why do you think it's eroding? Or do you agree with the idea that it's eroding?
Yeah, I think that a couple things are happening in the Trump era to the Mormon vote. I thought it was really interesting in 2016, and this is something I covered throughout the primaries, was the kind of steadfast and unusual Mormon resistance to Trump and Trumpism. And at the time, there was so much attention being given to the fact that conservative evangelicals were rallying around Trump and lining up behind him. And Mormons were sort of behaving the way that a lot of people thought the rest of the religious right would behave, right? Like Mormon voters were put off by his vulgarity and his mistresses and the way he talked about women. And, you know, Mormons practically fielded their own independent presidential candidate just to get out of voting for him, right? But, you know, 8 years of Trumpism at the center of Republican life has eroded it. But I would put it a little differently. I think what's happening is that Mormons overall are becoming less Republican. They used to be the most steadfastly Republican religious group in the country. That has clearly changed according to most available polling data. But Mormon Republicans are becoming more Trumpy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in some of the focus groups that you did, that really comes through pretty clearly. Like those who identify as Republicans in Utah are becoming more MAGA. They're not, you know, very fond of people like Mitt Romney or Governor Spencer Cox. But I think if you walked into your average kind of Mormon chapel in Provo, Utah, and struck up a conversation about politics, you'd find a lot of people identifying as independents now, even though they're pretty conservative, and a lot of people who just don't want to talk about politics at all because they're so put off by Donald Trump.
Yeah. You know, because I'm personally obsessed with Mitt Romney as a renegade anti-Trump Republican, and because I read everything you do, we convened actually three different Mormon groups. I've always been interested in what's going on in Utah. And I'll be honest, too, you're always interested, too, in seeing whether or not there's some focus groups of Mormon voters. So
absolutely.
We did three different groups. In February, we did a group of Mormon Republicans who had some grain of skepticism about Trump. So that ranged from somebody who'd voted for Hillary and Biden to a two-time Trump voter who's on the fence in 2024. And there were a lot of sort of former Evan McMullen voters in between. And I think that's the category of voter you were just referencing. So there's a whole group that are kind of like these Trump skeptical Republicans. And then in March, we did a group of Mormon Republicans who voted for Trump in 2020. And then in June, so very recently, we did a group of Utah Republicans, not just Mormons, who voted for Trump in 2020, which was probably the most MAGA group of the three, is when we kind of didn't use Mormon as a screen. And then you got really MAGA. So I want to start and get into the first group, right? So these are Republicans who, to one degree or another, they're Republicans, like you said, but they're just Trump skeptics. So let's listen to how they talked about Trump's character.
I mean, I'd prefer the president to be a good person to represent our country. But if it's someone as bad as Trump, in my opinion, he was a really bad person, breaking laws and such. I don't think having a president like that is just right. I feel like it's my obligation to make sure someone who is breaking laws or doing really bad things like that, to make sure they don't get into office. Although, if they're just like a bad person that done bad things, if they have good policies, sure, I'd vote for them. But I just felt like it was a little too much with Trump.
You know, I used to subscribe to the theory of like vote for the lesser of two evils, but a vote for the lesser of two evils is still a vote for evil, right? So I'm excited that we have this third party option now, and I have a lot of hope for it. And that's definitely where I'm thinking to place my vote.
It's not just like he's kind of terrible. He's just excessively terrible. And the fact that like he has all these allegations and things against him, but still has the audacity to run is mind blowing to me, that he could even get this far. But again, a lot of us were surprised he won in the first place in the original election. If he's willing to do all of these things, even get caught and not be convicted yet, but have all of these things happen, and he still has the audacity to be like, oh, it's fine, I'll just run for president, no big deal.
It just blows me away that with all the progress we've made with this hashtag MeToo, you know, Matt Lauer and all these people that have been canceled because of things they've done, why is he not canceled? I feel strongly that if you're the type of person that is willing to, for example, with Trump, since we're being so honest, lie and cheat and be terribly inappropriate with the women in your life and be a bad person to the people who are most important to your life, then why would you not be willing to be a bad person in business and in politics? If you're willing to cheat on, how many wives did he cheat on, and sexually assault how many women? And if he's willing to do that in his personal life, then why would he have any problems lying, cheating, stealing in business? I mean, I feel like your family relationships are the ones that are the most important and that you should treat with the most care and caution. And he doesn't, to me, doesn't seem to care at all about those relationships. So why would he not, you know, get in bed with Putin, or, you know, steal documents or lie or do whatever else he has to do to win and to get what he wants?
So these voters all identify as Republicans. But I got to say, one of the things that was interesting to me every time I go to Utah, I used to go there a lot for business. And one of the things is that, like, these people would clearly be Democrats. Like, I'd be talking to someone who was clearly a Democrat, but they would identify as a Republican. And it was because just if you were in Utah, you just did identify as a Republican. And Joe Biden got, I believe, the highest percentage of the Democratic vote ever in Utah. And it was only still like 34%, but it was pretty high. My producer is reminding me that it was 38%.
Oh, 38,
and it was the highest since 1964. So,
you
know, so can you just explain to me, like, what's the relationship between voters in Utah who are disproportionately Mormon and the Republican Party?
Yeah, well, I think a couple things are going on there. You know, in some ways, living in Utah as a Republican is like living in New York City as a Democrat, right? Where like being a Democrat in Utah outside of like a couple, you know, Salt Lake City precincts and Park City is just not going to get you anywhere. You'll have no influence over who gets elected because the Republican primaries are the elections, right? So that's part of it. I will also say that up until Donald Trump, basically, it was kind of just a cultural thing. Like, there was this attachment between the Republican Party and Mormonism, where, you know, they went almost hand in hand. I can't remember the exact numbers, but in 2016, when I was doing a lot of reporting on this, from what I could tell, the average Republican presidential nominee would get somewhere between 70 and 80% of the Mormon vote. I mean, 70 to 80%, like that is an enormous percentage, right? But the other thing I would say, and I think this is an important kind of nuance, is that, you know, when you talk to researchers who study evangelical politics, for example, they will say that people who identify as evangelicals are not going to church all that often. Their faith is not a huge part of their day-to-day lives. Evangelical has almost become a political descriptor for a lot of people, right? Not for everyone. I know a lot of evangelical people of very sincere faith, but just when you're surveying people, especially in a political context, evangelical is a political identifier as much as it is a religious one. Latter-day Saint is still very much a religious identifier. And for most of the people who are active practicing Mormons, they may be Republicans or identify as Republicans, but that is not their primary identifier. Their faith is pretty upfront and, you know, very interwoven into their day-to-day lives in a way that makes these tensions that you heard in some of those first clips that you played really kind of present and difficult to grapple with. Like when the Republican Party becomes a cult of personality around somebody who so manifestly embodies the antithesis of your religious values, and you're going to church every Sunday and your entire social life is built around your faith, it's a lot harder to kind of deal with those inconsistencies. And I think that's why you hear so much ambivalence in the voices of these people in your groups.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it does occur to me as I'm thinking about this episode, people might be like, why are we doing something directly on Utah? Like, it's not a swing state. It is have this like very unique profile that doesn't really reflect on the rest of the country. But I guess one of the reasons I have been deeply interested in Utah is because for those of us who think about like potential third parties, or even in 2016, those of us were trying to figure out like, how do you beat Donald Trump? Utah was one of these places where like, well, maybe Utah would vote for Evan McMullen. You'd take it off the map. You'd rob Trump of some electoral votes. And Evan then ran again as a third party candidate. Democrats didn't run anybody in 2022. He ran for Senate against Mike Lee. Didn't win, but it was one of the closer attempts that somebody has made to have like a really serious third party, like an independent, where the Democrats totally stood down and sort of let him run as the alternative to Lee.
He got over 40% of the vote,
he got
right? Like 45% or something like that. So he made a real run at it. But, you know, partisanship is so entrenched that it is hard to kind of get people who have voted Republican their whole lives to pull the lever for someone else. But Sarah, to your point, that's such an important point you're making, because I feel like since 2016, every potentially viable or frankly even non-viable third party attempt has spent some time in Utah, right? You even see it this cycle with RFK. He's in Utah trying to drum up support, because there is a sense, and I think it's basically true, that Utahns and Mormons are especially unsatisfied with their choices in the Trump era. And so there's always this idea that like, maybe we could pick off enough Mormon votes to swing Utah.
All right. So all of those people we just heard, they voted for Trump in 2020, and they were going to either vote third party or abstain in 2024, to your point, like they were thinking about RFK. Now, that was back in February. That group's a little bit old. So, you know, they could have changed their minds by now. But I want to get into what this same group, so this same sort of Trump skeptical group, said about immigration. Because I know, McKay, that's something you were particularly interested in, because Mormons, and you'd sort of think this was true of evangelicals as well, but there's like a deep well of commitment to people who are refugees. But it's also one of the most animating elements of the Republican Party now is kind of its anti-immigrant sentiment. So let's listen to how these Trump skeptical Republicans talked about immigration.
I think a lot of these immigrants are good people who are here trying to make a better life for themselves and are working really hard. But then I also see these news stories in New York or Florida where I feel they're trying to just boost up the voters, and they are giving immigrants 3 to 6 months free living in a hotel, maid service every day, money to spend on food, taking care of everything, because it brings them into the country and it brings in more votes. And I don't feel like Trump did that, but Biden has definitely been doing that. So that's been really frustrating to me. But I would vote for Barney the dinosaur at this point over Biden or Trump. I'll vote for myself if I have to. With a good conscience, I will not vote for either of them. I just think they're horrible people. And I'm so disappointed in our country of incredible intellects and thinkers. And this is where we're at. Like this? Really? Again?
Since I do work with immigrants and refugee families, and all of them come, so far in my experience, a lot more skilled than most of the Americans that I meet on a daily basis. And they're the only ones that are willing to do some of the jobs that we have here. And so a big reason why our economy didn't completely collapse, in my experience, was because of the immigrant workers who were willing to do the things that Americans weren't willing to do, or we got stimulus payments and they didn't. And so a lot of us had more options when the stimulus payments happened. Not saying I believe that was a good or a bad thing, but I see a huge divide in the people here in the U.S. I don't see a huge divide in the people who come here from other places. And that makes me both sad, but also hopeful that we can learn from other cultures and other countries that aren't hemorrhaging from spending so much money, aren't divided family-wise, and aren't divided culturally and things like that.
I worry about immigration, just everyone just flowing across the border, both for terrorism and also just becoming a burden on society, because many of these people come just with few skills and some come with bad intentions. I think most are good, but they're coming the wrong way.
So that last woman was the only two-time Trump voter in that focus group. And so it doesn't surprise me that actually she had a different view from the rest of the group on immigration. But, you know, you wrote a piece in late 2020 about Mormonism called The Most American Religion. And you wrote about how Mormonism has been more resistant to MAGA, particularly some of the nativist parts of it, than the rest of the GOP, in part because of the suffering and persecution of the early church has made its adherents more sensitive to the plights of immigrants and refugees. Is that still true? Or do you feel like the MAGA view of immigration is starting to become more prevalent in Utah?
Yeah. I mean, I thought what you heard in those answers is what I've kind of seen anecdotally in my reporting and conversations in Utah, is that you have this kind of clash between the messaging they're receiving from their church, which is generally very pro-refugee, pro-immigrant, and their own faith's history, and the experiences of a lot of men and women who go and serve missions in Latin America and come home with kind of very nuanced, humane views of these issues. It's hard to actually overstate how much that affects this issue. Like, I served a mission in Texas. I was assigned to learn Spanish, which meant I was spending almost all of my time with immigrants, a lot of them undocumented. And you can't help but, you know, after spending 2 years with people who are trying to make money, send it home, scratch out a life here, living, you know, 10 guys in an apartment, you know, like, you obviously feel for them. It's really hard to come away from that not having kind of a nuanced, humane view of the issue. But what I was saying is that you have that side of it, the kind of innately Mormon perspective on immigration, clashing with the broader kind of Trump era Republican messaging and conservative media messaging. I mean, the first woman you played was like, I think that they're coming for good reasons and they're good people, they have good intentions. But then you see these news stories about what's happening in New York, and like, where is she seeing those news stories, right? Who is making that a narrative? You know, it's the kind of right-wing pro-Trump constellation of outlets that is trying to scare their constituency about immigration, right? And so I think that in my conversations over and over, I've seen people who sort of innately, after, you know, lifetime spent in the church, wanting to give the benefit of the doubt to undocumented immigrants and refugees, but then they're being exposed on TV or in their social media algorithms to these scary stories about, you know, criminal immigrant invasions. And they don't know how to reconcile those things. And I think that that's part of what's kind of deteriorating the anti-Trump stand that Latter-day Saints took in 2016 and have really taken for years, is just like continued exposure to right-wing talking points and media narratives that don't kind of jibe with their experiences.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, we're going to take a quick break here and have a word from our sponsor. All right, so I want to get into these voters' reactions to a guy you literally wrote the book on, Mitt Romney. So let's listen to some of the residual goodwill for him we heard in the group of less Trump-friendly Mormon Republicans.
I'm actually a big advocate of him. I had the chance to meet him this summer. I was impressed with him. I agree with a lot of his policies. I appreciate that he's willing to not just be working with the Republicans. And I feel like he does go out of his way to try to do what makes the most sense, Republican or Democrat, instead of straight Republican, which I feel like if more people would do that, be like, what's best for the country instead of what's best for our political party, that we would all be better off. And I feel like he's done a really great job of trying to meet both sides in the middle. And I appreciate that he's out there saying, look, I think he's like 75, 76. He's saying, I'm going to be in my 80s by the time I would be done. That's too old. And he's saying that, I think, also to Trump and Biden, saying, that's too old. It's too old to be in your 80s and be running this country.
I remember not really liking him much when I was younger, maybe because I was in more of my rebellion against the church stage. However, he really impressed me. And I think, I'm trying to remember the exact time it was. And then I met him and he's great in person. He's got super good vibes. But I think it was the Trump impeachment vote that he was the only member of his party that voted in favor of that. And that struck me as a very courageous thing to do, to go against the party and vote his conscience like that.
It frustrates me that so many Republicans are so afraid to go against Trump, more so than other presidents we've had that are Republican. So I do appreciate that he is willing to do what he thinks is right and vote the way he wants to. And he did make people angry, very upset. It was not a popular thing to do. I also think he would have a chance to win if he ran for re-election. And I don't agree with everything that he does. I think he's very, very bright. And I think his understanding of international relations, he's one of the best. And he has predicted things and warned people about things that may happen. And he's been right most of the time. And I think we're in an era where we're in tenuous times with our international relations. And I would hope that we would have somebody who is savvy about that.
Why do you think Joe Biden hasn't made Mitt Romney like Secretary of State or something? Don't we think that Biden should do something with Mitt to like unity government type thing?
I think because he knows that it would be stressful for me having to update the book and he's trying to do me a solid.
It is all about you. Yep.
No, you know, I hear that question a lot, especially because, and I report about this in the book, like, they actually have a good relationship. They've worked together on a bunch of bipartisan legislation. They've become kind of like bros, you know, they talk on the phone. Biden gave his family a tour of the White House when he had, you know, his son and his family in town. So, you know, I don't know. It's possible that, you know, if there were some kind of endorsement or something to happen, it would happen later in the year. But listening to those comments, it's just so funny because they reflect probably what almost everyone in all these focus groups would have said about Mitt Romney 5 years ago, right? Maybe 10 years ago, whatever it is. In the pre-Trump era, Mitt Romney was a hero to Mormons, especially Mormon conservatives. I like that one woman who said that, you know, in her rebellious era, she didn't like Mitt Romney. But that's partly because Romney was like an avatar of mainstream Mormonism. He was seen as the kind of embodiment of Mormon values, Mormon aesthetics. He had his big family. He had a successful career. His great hair. You know,
have great hair.
He is like the picture of like a Mormon family's Christmas card that you would send home, right? Mm-hmm. And like, it has been really striking to see, and one of those people alluded to it, how many people who previously loved him have turned on him in the Trump era. And I think, again, it's caused a lot of dissonance because, like, if you had asked these people 10 years ago, you know, there's going to be a feud between Donald Trump and Mitt Romney. Who are you going to side with? Like, it would have been a laughable question. But, you know, a lot of them are now siding with Donald Trump.
Yeah, we're going to get to those voters. I want to ask you, though, you were talking to Romney regularly as he weighed running for re-election in 2024. And you write that it's not at all clear to him whether the American experiment can continue to hold. And there's a metaphor from your conversations with him that authoritarianism is like a gargoyle lurking over the cathedral of America. So he's so nervous about this. He's so afraid of this authoritarian creep. And yet he doesn't want to spend six more of his remaining years in the Senate. So why do you think he's walking away?
I think there are personal reasons that have to do with his wife's health and his health and things in his family that just make it really hard to justify spending the last few remaining good years he might have left in the Senate. You know, that's an understandable human reason. I think there's also a part of him that feels like he has been so fully exiled by the Republican Party that to try to hold on to this seat and spend another 6 years in these Republican caucus meetings with J.D. Vance and, you know, Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and all these people who hate him would be pretty miserable. I think he also just genuinely doesn't know how much more good he can do in the Senate. Yeah. And that is something he struggled with even going in. When he made his pros and cons list when he was deciding to run in the first time, he showed it to me. And one of the items on the cons list was, I'll only be 1 out of 100, right? Yeah. This is a guy who wanted to be president. He's been a boss for his whole life, basically, right? Being 1 of 100 was a tough thing for him. And when he looks back on his Senate term, he's proud of some of the bipartisan legislation he passed. He's certainly proud of the stand he took against Trump. But he also kind of only puts so much value on, like, symbolic gestures, you know, being the one guy who voted to convict Trump in his party made him historic. But also there's a very pragmatic part of him that's like, it didn't do anything. He's still president after that, right? And so I think that he does struggle with the notion of staying in this seat for six more years, not accomplishing all that much in case there's some kind of emergency he might be able to help with.
Yeah. You know, I'm a little torn on this because I think there's a little part of me that for every single one of these guys, it's like, actually, you make a bigger difference than you think. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so important to have somebody sing up for. I remember just weeping at Mitt Romney when he voted to impeach Trump the first time and he made that speech. And I don't know, his leadership has really mattered. On the other hand, you know, the longer that people like Mitt and Liz kind of stayed in the Republican Party, the more there was a category of people that was able to be like, well, I'm a Mitt Romney Republican. And that allows people to kind of dodge what the party has become. Mm-hmm. And so there's another part of me that's just more like, you know, you need people to see this party clearly. And keeping people like Liz and Mitt around doesn't do that. It allows people to think it's something different than it is.
Well, to that point, the kind of unspoken thing here, and Mitt will like hate hearing me say this because he would disagree with it, but like he might not have won if he ran for re-election.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of crazy thing about how unpopular he's become in this party. Like winning a Republican primary in Utah would have been a real uphill battle. It would have cost him a lot of money. He would have had to expend an enormous amount of energy and he might still have lost. And then, you know, he could have run as an independent. And I think there's actually a good case that as an independent, he might have actually won. But it's untested, or it's been tested and always failed, at least so far. So I think he looked at that scenario and thought it was too much of a long shot. But that is part of it. I will say Romney is adamant that if he had decided to run, he would have made sure he won. But I don't know.
Well, he can be adamant, but I will submit for the record, this group from March, who I think reflect why Romney might have had a tough time winning the primary if he'd chosen to run. Let's listen.
He's a people pleaser, and I'm kind of guilty of that from time to time. And so I know how that kind of works. And you're not your most genuine, honest self when you're trying to get as many possible people to like you and to agree with you. And I know people think compromise is a strength, but I think sometimes saying no is a strength. And so what happened with the so-called January 6th insurrection, he had concluded that Trump had caused it. My question to him is, where's your judgment? Where's your discernment? Who told you that Trump caused it? On what evidence did you base that on?
I think he's a good person. You know, he did a lot for our Olympics, and I think he ran on that record. But, you know, the way that he went about the impeachment of Trump twice was totally uncalled for. You know, I even wrote him a letter, and I just got blanket one. It says, well, because he caused the insurrection. And I'm like, you're not even listening. So that's why I gave a woohoo, is just because he finally saw the writing on the wall.
I don't necessarily love Romney. I feel like he is a flip-flopper. I'm glad to see him go. I also admire somebody who stands alone, even against a big party, because all of us have been put in that situation at times where maybe it's not as explainable as we want it to be, but we have to go with our gut. And if that is the true reason that he did, then I give him props for that.
That woman was the one person in the group who tried to make a little bit of a pro-Romney, hey, you know, he's got character for standing alone argument. But she was kind of doing it just to be devil's advocate because the group was pretty locked in on the idea that Romney is bad. But you know what struck me is that having done a lot of evangelical groups, they talk about Romney the way that evangelical groups talk about Mike Pence, which is like, he's a good man, but I don't want to vote for him. You know, he's done all these things wrong. So it's clear that Romney no longer has much of a home in the GOP. And as you wrote, he's joked about starting a new party with Joe Manchin. But how does he view the long-term outlook for the Republican Party? And like, what is he going to do about it? Or what does he think people should do about it?
Yeah, I mean, he is very focused on finding ways to de-radicalize the party, right? I write about this in the book, but like the last year, really the last few months of my time working on this in earnest, I would go over to his house every week on Capitol Hill, and he would be like coming up with some new scheme to save the Republican Party or save the country, right? And for a while, it was he was going to run in 2024 as an independent presidential candidate and run this kind of cathartic scream of a presidential campaign where he just said exactly what he believed. And, you know, he knew he wouldn't win, but he'd be able to hold everyone to account. Then he gave that up. Then, especially because he was convinced that he would end up helping Donald Trump if he did.
He's
that.
Right.
So then he had this idea of starting a third party with Joe Manchin, but it wouldn't field a presidential candidate, at least not this year, and would instead just try to raise a ton of money and give it to whichever candidate was closer to their kind of centrist positions, their centrist platform, which would probably end up being Joe Biden. But the idea was to kind of make Joe Biden more accountable to them than to the kind of AOC Bernie Sanders wing of his party. And so I think he's really in a tough spot because he does believe in a lot of kind of traditionally conservative ideas. And I've continued to talk to him. And when I bring up Joe Biden and you know, his administration, and he'll always say, you know, I like Joe, but man, his policies drive me crazy. And so it's really hard for people like him to kind of hold their nose and vote for Biden. On the other hand, he knows the Republican Party under Trump is a catastrophe. And so when I ask him about the long-term health of the party, he's very pessimistic about the short term, right? He thinks that people like him don't have much of a place in the party, that it's probably going to continue on like this as long as Donald Trump is the main character of the party, and maybe even beyond that, depending on who comes next. In the long term, he's hoping for generational change, right? He's hoping that the rising generation of young right-leaning people will essentially reject Trumpism, that they will at some point see what happened to the Trump era Republican Party, decide that it's not for them and change it. But, you know, I think the sound you just made is indicative of kind of the response, which is like, the problem is that young conservative people coming of age in the Trump era, this is the Republican Party they know. And it's going to be really hard for a rising generation to just reinvent the party out of whole cloth when they've been raised on a steady diet of, you know, right-wing trolling and, you know, Breitbart-type theatrics and Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump. It's hard to see how those people decide, we're going to steer the party back toward Mitt Romney and Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I mean, the next generation of political leaders is Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance and a bunch of people who have absolutely capitulated to Trump and Trumpism. And then when the voters, as you note, and is the reason I made this sound, anybody who's talking to young Republicans right now knows these people are coming for Trump. Like, they are here because they affirmatively like Trump. Nikki Haley makes no sense to them because they don't remember when Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, and Marco Rubio were taking a big stand against Trump. Like, they're not coming for Reagan policies or Paul Ryanism. Like, they are here for the Trump of it all. And so the idea that the younger generation is what is going to deliver this is some wish casting. But man, God bless him for for his attempts to help. I hope there is a big role for Mitt from the outside, but it's interesting that you just said you think it'll come later. With all my respect and admiration that I have for Mitt Romney, I do not understand people who see Trump clearly and understand the existential threat that he poses to the country and to the Republican Party that they once loved, and then say, and I won't vote for the one person standing between that guy and the White House. This is a phenomenon on the right, even among a lot of my compatriots, that I like can't understand. And I understand not liking Joe Biden's policies, like student loan debt forgiveness. That drives me crazy. It is a handout to wealthier people and also people who went to college, not people who didn't go to college, which is most people. And on top of that, you got to pay back the money you borrow, right? I could have a whole rant where I sound like a Republican again, and I could be really annoyed. And then, to make it worse, Joe Biden ignored the Supreme Court when they told him he couldn't do it and went around the Supreme Court, which I hate as a conservative. Mm-hmm. Okay, all that being said, I'm going to let that be like, and that is why I cannot endorse Joe Biden in the face of Donald Trump, who's going to pull us out of NATO, is one of the worst humans to ever occupy the White House, hates women, is completely immoral, completely debased, did a coup last time, won't accept the results of election, probably a run for third term. Like, these things to me don't exist on the same plane. And so I'm always just a little bit like, Mitt, you see it clearly. You will endorse Biden eventually, won't you? What do you think, Willie?
I don't know. I will say this. I think this comes from his two failed presidential campaigns, where he got a lot of endorsements and big coveted endorsements, and it made no difference at the end of the day. He doesn't believe that his endorsement would matter at all. Oh. He sees it more in terms of like, this would be a symbolic gesture, and maybe it's one worth making. And again, I don't think he's closed the door to it. But I also think that he doesn't see himself as an influential enough political figure that endorsing Joe Biden would swing the election or even swing a single state?
Well, it could swing 3-4% of voters, which might be the margin in most of these swing states. So whatever. Okay. Got to take a break here again. Pay some. So even though Mitt Romney is retiring, Governor Spencer Cox is one of the more serious and responsible elected Republicans in the country. He accepted the 2020 election results, which seems like a low bar, but that's the thing he did that sets him apart. And he made a point to avoid the kind of culture warring that GOP voters have come to demand, which might actually cost him his upcoming primary. He also has an initiative as chair of the National Governors Association called Disagree Better, where he's made a series of very earnest media appearances and PSAs with Democratic governors promoting civil discourse. Let's listen to a clip of one of those.
I'm Spencer Cox, Republican governor of Utah.
And I'm Jared Polis, Democratic governor of Colorado.
And we're here to help save your family dinners.
You know what we're talking about.
You're halfway through your second helping of mashed potatoes when your MAGA uncle decides to share his thoughts on the latest election conspiracy.
We all have that uncle.
Or instead of passing the salt, your woke niece passes along a particularly controversial fact that she read on social media.
Or maybe you're the one with the strong opinions. You know you're right. And the other side is a bunch of misguided weirdos. But there's a healthy way to deal with conflicting opinions. Actually, it's okay to disagree.
It's not just okay, it's crucial.
Did you just disagree with me about disagreeing?
Healthy disagreement means not assuming that the other side is deluded, misinformed, or actively trying to overthrow America.
A little respect and curiosity keeps resentment off the dinner table.
And out of your social media feeds.
Love that. Love that for Spencer Cox. And I do love Spencer Cox. And I love Jared Polis. I'm not sure this is the solution to what ails us, but I do want to listen to how our most recent focus group of Utah Republicans, who were not all Mormons, and they all voted for Trump in 2020, talked about Cox, starting with what they thought of this particular initiative.
I like the idea because I don't like the way things are, and I would like us to get along better. On the other hand, I don't want to give up my views and beliefs just to appease someone who totally disagrees with me. But that doesn't mean we can't do it in a more civil way. Will it make any difference at all? I doubt it.
I don't think that a governor or any kind of government coming in and saying, look, we need to do this and let's put some cute little ads together that we're all going to get along is going to make a difference. He is just another rhino. I feel like that he has split the party even more. I think he's come out more on the side of Biden than I've ever seen a governor in Utah do as far as going with the Democrat. I feel like that the issue with letting boys and girls sports, so that's a huge red flag for me. I think a lot of when he took a stand, when he could have clearly not and let people have their own opinions. And I think that it was a bit of a turnoff for me immediately. So I will not be voting for Spencer Cox this time around.
He's been a little disappointing for me. So I've been surprised to see some of the things he's supported or talked about. I felt like it's not been what I thought he would do. I have no idea what it's like to be in a position like that. I'm sure he's trying to appeal to the more liberal and democratic people within the state, and maybe he's trying to be more unifying, but I don't know if I will be voting for him in this next election. I need to learn more about the other candidates that are going against him.
I didn't vote for him initially when the primaries and things. Once he was the nominee, I voted for him reluctantly, and frankly, he hasn't been as bad as I thought he would be. I think he's been okay in some areas. In some areas, I totally disagree with him.
So Spencer Cox is heavily favored to win his primary, but obviously not everyone is super into him. What do you make of Spencer Cox out there? He's such a unique, he's like trying to do it differently than everybody else.
Yeah, well, it's sort of, although in fact, like listening to that ad that you played, it sounded like an ad that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints would have run in like the 1990s. They had this like series called about family. And it was like, isn't it about time? Like the whole tone of it, the way they talked, it's so earnest. And so in some ways, he's a throwback to kind of a style of Mormon politics that plays really well in Utah and maybe outside of Utah, not so well. Although I will say something interesting about that ad. So that ad was born out of, in 2020, an ad that he made with his Democratic opponent who was running against him for governor, where they both kind of appeared together, similar vibes, like very like friendly and chummy with each other. And both said, whatever happens this election, we're going to accept the results of the election. And this was when Trump was already making his kind of rigged election claims. And what's interesting is that a couple of years later, they showed that at Stanford University, the Strengthening Democracy Challenge, they did a series of interventions where they showed this to a bunch of voters and found that it significantly reduced partisan animosity among those who watched it. So I think that's where this Disagree Better initiative was born. The people in your focus group did not like it, but I think that those people also are an example of like the very online, very engaged Republican, self-identified Republicans in Utah are MAGA types, right? And they don't like Spencer Cox. They don't like Mitt Romney. They are very suspicious of any kind of initiative about consensus building or compromise or civility or whatever. I don't know that they're representative of the mainstream of the kind of Utah Republican voters because, at least according to polls, Spencer Cox is way ahead in Republican primaries. He's probably going to win the kind of normie Republican vote in Utah. And that's his base in Utah. That base is wide enough and un-Trumpy enough in Utah to probably help him get his second term. I'm not sure that's true in very many red states anymore. I think in most red states, Spencer Cox would get like 7-10% in the primaries and have to drop out.
I think that's right. I mean, look, I love Spencer Cox. And even with the sort of saccharine nature of that ad, I'd take that every day over, you know, Donald Trump, you know, says that this person is an idiot and a rapist and whatever. Like, great. So like two guys talking about how it's good to disagree. Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, Spencer Cox is basically like every democracy reformer, every Democrat's kind of like, see, you could be a Republican like this. This would be fine with us.
I interviewed him on stage at the Atlantic Festival in D.C. last year, and he made that joke when he came on. He was like, well, Mitt Romney's retiring, so I knew you guys needed another one of us, so here I am. You know, like, he's the Republican you can put on stage at the Atlantic Festival in Washington, and everybody likes him, and it goes great. You know?
Yeah, he's probably getting so many calls. He won't have enough time in his calendar because people are so desperate to try to do bipartisan things. But, you know, they're like, but how do I do it without putting an election denier on stage? And so, like, he's one of the on the very short list of people that you can call. And he also, one of the things he did, and people brought this up in the groups, is that he vetoed a bill banning transgender youth from sports. And he said when he did it, you know, I struggle to understand so much of it and the science is conflicting. When in doubt, however, I always try to err on the side of kindness, mercy, and compassion. And he had previously said, these kids are, they're just trying to stay alive. And I'll tell you, I'm very conflicted about the trans issue in sports, especially at the older, less so with like little kids. And he's not actually the only Republican to do this. I want to say was it Kay Ivey? There was another Republican who did this sort of out of a sense of like, I don't think we need to demonize these kids just because. Like, let's figure this out a different way. And that does set him apart, right? Like, he does lead with a kind of kindness. Mormon, whatever aside, I think there's just a lot of people who would love to see more of that in politics.
Yeah. I just think that he doesn't go into his day every day looking to pick a fight, right? And he's not gravitating toward culture war issues. He doesn't want to be on Fox News. He doesn't want to be a conservative celebrity. That's, I think, a huge part of it, right? Like, he's not angling to be invited to Mar-a-Lago. He kind of actually wants to run his state. And I think that, like, that leads you to make different decisions. Now, he's made a lot of decisions that liberal people in his state and nationally really don't like. And, you know, he's defended those decisions and he is a conservative guy. But I just don't think that he's as interested in stoking culture war as he is in just kind of trying to figure out the most sane and humane way to govern his state. Doesn't mean he doesn't make mistakes, and he does. And it doesn't mean that he's not going to take unpopular stances, especially, you know, to the kind of people who might attend the Atlantic Festival or listen to this podcast even. But like, he's not interested in hurting people for the sake of politics, right? The cruelty is the point, as my colleague Adam Serwer famously wrote about Trump era politics. Like, he's not interested in that style of politics.
Yeah. Okay. Well, for those of you curious about what a Senate may look like without Mitt Romney there to hold the line in a conservative state, we do have some insights for you on this. The Republican primary is being held this month to replace Romney in the Senate, and there are four main candidates running. There's Congressman John Curtis, the former mayor of Provo, who's the front runner and the most normal candidate in the race. He supported a censure resolution of Trump after January 6th, but now he's touting his ability to work with Trump because that's what Republicans do. Then there's Trent Staggs, a mayor who Trump endorsed, and Brad Wilson, the Speaker of the Utah House, who's been endorsed by Spencer Cox and who kind of splits the difference between sort of MAGA and normie. And then there's Jason Walton, a MAGA businessman who got a lot of honorable mentions in our most recent group. Curtis is leading in all of the polls and he's a known quantity, but, you know, a lot of people in the group seemed open to alternatives. They just didn't know that much about them. So let's listen to what 2020 Trump voters in Utah have said about Curtis recently.
I actually like John Curtis. He doesn't always go to the right. He doesn't go to the left. He goes in the middle, but I've been to many of his talks and talked to him. And I don't know how many people know that in the House, he's put together one of the biggest caucuses with the right and the left. because he's a pretty good guy at being able to bring people together when they don't agree on stuff and put some things together. And it's just non-existent in Congress right now.
I don't really see anything particularly negative with him, but I haven't really looked into the other guys either. So
Curtis, he's the leading one, isn't he? He seemed a lot more like the establishment Republican that's been in there forever and wants to be in there forever. And that kind of turned me off about him. I like some of the other ones that were speaking, just so they don't go to Washington and just keep doing the same old party things.
So like I alluded to, Curtis is leading by at least 18 points in all the recent public polls, but about a third of the voters are undecided. And you could hear that in the groups where people were like, I don't know that much about him. And so back in 2023, I was thinking about this because there's a special election for Congress where former state rep Becky Edwards led by 20 points in all the public polling and then still lost, kind of like in a little bit of a shocker, in part because she'd voted for Joe Biden in 2020. And so she lost to a more MAGA candidate. So there's precedent for these undecideds breaking hard against kind of the normie person. What do you think? Do you think that that's a chance here, or do you think Curtis kind of has it locked up?
No, I think that anything could happen. I think what Curtis has going for him is name recognition. He's been serving as a member of the House for years now. Before that, he was the mayor of Provo, a very popular mayor of one of the bigger cities in the state. And he has his business record. You know, like, he is in the mold of the kind of statewide Republican that Utahns elect. But, you know, I say that knowing that this is also a state that elected Mitt Romney and Mike Lee to serve in the Senate. And so the Utah Republican primary electorate can seem a little kind of schizophrenic. The reality is what you're noting is that there is a populist right-wing element of the party, and there is a more normie kind of church-going Mormon-like average Republican voter who's busy with life and doesn't pay that close attention to politics. You know, if I were to put money on it, I would probably bet on Curtis getting through the primary. But these candidates can catch fire, and a lot of it depends on kind of the climate on any given year. You know, Mike Lee rode to victory in the Tea Party wave when there was a very strong anti-establishment sentiment. He ousted Bob Bennett, who's kind of a establishment stalwart, right? So that could happen. But I tend to think that Curtis has a pretty good shot and will come as close as any of these candidates will to acting like Mitt Romney in the Senate. I say that without having spent, I think, any time talking to John Curtis. I think I met him years and years ago, but I don't know him well. But he is as close to a sort of Mitt Romney Republican as there is in this field.
Well, I take that as a real compliment to him. McKay Coppins, thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to all of you for listening to another episode of the Focus Group podcast. Remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to The Bulwark on YouTube. We will catch you next week.